really a pleasure for me to be here. Thanks for having me. And just add to the background that Abby gave. It was really an honor to be invited to give these talks. I had been in Rochester for about 3.5 years, moved here for the job at Hobart William Smith. And when I got here, one of the first things I did was I was hired as a historian of Asian religions at Hobart William Smith. And so I looked for some places where people are practicing Asian religions as centers where I could possibly bring some of my students. Since I was living in Rochester, I looked in this area as well as around Geneva. And I found a Zen center, and John Pauline worked with me early on in my first year down there to bring my students here. And I've done that twice now, my Buddhism students, and it's been exceptional. It's been the highlight of the course for the students. I'm trained as a historian, and so bringing them to the center here, we also visit a Buddhist center in Ithaca, adds a lot to the experience of the students to see practice and to learn. John gave us a wonderful introduction to Zen in America, and then to the center here. And so it's really great for me, an honor for me to be here to talk about Buddhism with you all. And I'll just say that I hope to talk about it with you all. So the talk is designed to be somewhat informal. So if I'm saying things that you feel like you'd like a little bit of elaboration on, or you want me to slow down or something, just let me know. Right, I have a lot of information today. Today happens to be the most sweeping of the three talks that I'll give. A lot of history in particular. And what I'll be talking about is I'll start by giving some of the intellectual, the religious, and the socioeconomic background preceding and during the time the Buddha was born in South Asia. And I'll explain why that's important and why scholars are interested in that material in just a second. But as I said, feel free to let me know if you're not understanding something. I would much rather slow down and not get through everything and have everybody follow the narrative than to barrel through and have folks not keep up, I guess. So after I'm done giving some of that background, I was also asked to give a few words about some of the major traditions that developed in response to the Buddha's life. And so I'll say a few things about a few of those traditions at the end of that talk today, too. So with that, I'll begin with the title, The Quest for the Historical Buddha. First, let me just ask, is where I'm standing all right? You know, can you all see? Can you see enough? If I'm in the way, let me know. The Quest for the Historical Buddha, the title is borrowed from a subfield in religious studies, biblical studies, and in particular New Testament studies, where scholars have long had a preoccupation with trying to understand who the historical Jesus is. And you could go way back in time in scholarship to see where people have been trying to do this, but if we just go back to the early 20th century, a German scholar named Albert Schweitzer, whom you maybe know because he was a great theologian, but a lot of people know him. He's a Nobel Peace Prize winner, but know him as a physician, medical missionary, and so on. He wrote a book that was translated into English, and the title was The Quest for the Historical Jesus. And it's a peculiar translation of his title, and whether he liked it or not, I don't know. But it does nicely capture the method and the approach that he takes in that book. And in a nutshell, what that is that he studies about 2 or 3 centuries worth of presentations or depictions of Jesus Christ. They are considered to be historical depictions of this person. And what he notices is that we don't really get a unified picture of a historical being, but rather we learn a lot about the perspectives and the zeitgeist of the cultures in which the people who are presenting him lived. We don't learn so much about the history. That information that we get is still important, and clearly it reveals something about the nature of the tradition, of the Christian traditions that these people belong to. But if we really want to get to who the historical figure, he said, what we need to do is we need to understand the historical milieu in which this figure lived. And we need to take some of the things that we know with great certainty about him, when he lived, where he lived, and so on, and understand the intellectual, the economic, the social climate happened there, and try and then piece together a little bit about this person's life, his or her, if it's a woman, impact on that time and place to understand what this person was like, and that will increase our appreciation and increase our understanding of the influence thereafter and how different cultures appropriate this figure. In another field in religious studies, Buddhist studies, there's been a similar interest in understanding who the historical Buddha is, naturally so. And scholars have found the same sorts of things that Schweitzer found when he looked at Christianity, is that we see very different depictions of the Buddha if we look throughout generations, centuries of depictions of the Buddha, and they reflect the different cultures in which those presentations are coming from. Well, if we want to understand the historical Buddha, then maybe we need to look at the historical milieu in which the Buddha was born, what preceded him, and try and understand the sorts of arguments, the sorts of philosophies he was responding to, he was talking with, he was borrowing from, and so on and so forth. And that's really where this title is borrowed from, and that's what I'm going to talk about today, essentially. Now, I'll just add that for some people, the historicalness of these figures, people like Jesus, people like Buddha, is more important or it's less important. There are various reasons for critiquing this kind of approach to studying religious figures, and there's a lot of appreciation for it. It just depends on your position. Within the major branches of Buddhism itself, the historicalness, and particularly the humanness of the Buddha, of Gautama, the person we're talking about today, is a big point of difference, ideological difference, for example, between the Theravada tradition and the Mahayana traditions. And that's those two traditions I'll mention at the end. But you've probably, I would think you've probably heard of them. So with that, let me begin. I'm using a device I've never used before, so seems easy enough. So I've got some information. I assume that there's a general understanding and knowledge about the Buddha and Buddhism. So I gloss over or simply don't mention a number of things with the expectation that you already have that information. But I'll start with a few things that are probably known, and then I'll get right into it. So this figure, our current Buddha, is known by a number of names. We've got Gautama, Siddhartha, Shakyamuni, and Buddha. And there are more. Gautama, of course, is the family name of the current Buddha. Siddhartha is a name that was applied in later tradition. It translates, all of the names I give you also are the Sanskrit spellings. I should mention that. Not the Pali spellings, not any other Asian language spellings. I'm trained as a Sanskritist, and so it's simply more natural for me to give you those. They tend to be the oldest attestations of those words, too. And so it's a good place to start, in any case. So Siddhartha translates into one who has achieved his aim. And there are good reasons for that name. And you could find all sorts of different aspects of his life where Gautama achieves the aims that he set out to achieve. Shakyamuni is the name that you often see associated with historical Buddha. Shakyamuni is also a compound name. Shakya is the name of the clan that the Gautama family lived in, and Muni is a Sanskrit word for sage. And so people refer to him as the sage of the Shakya clan. And this is a name you'll also see often associated with him. And of course, Buddha. And this is a Sanskrit word. It just means awakened. If you call somebody that, with a capital B, it's an awakened one, right? Somebody who's awakened. And he, of course, was called this after his great awakening, after his great night-long meditation in Bodh Gaya, when he achieved awakening. So, quick lifetime sketch. Up until about the mid-20th century, the dates of his life were this, 563 to 483 BCE. And that held sway for a long time. But around the mid-20th century, scholars started suggesting that maybe he was actually lived later, as much as a century later. For the talk today, I'll kind of cut it down the middle. There's no point for us to get into the nuts and bolts of dates like that. So we'll just say 5th century BCE. Right? He likely lived around the 5th century BCE. And that should suffice for us. A few points. His father, King Suddhodana, his mother, Queen Maya, who died shortly after he was born, and was raised by his stepmother, Mahaprajapati. Those things, important family points in particular.
Oh, just give you a little more room here.
Thanks. You all right?
Yes.
the important thing to take away from this, which will come up again in a few minutes, is that he was born into as a prince, born into a family of a king. And he lived, if you're familiar with his childhood story, and his adult, much of his young adult life, he lived a very luxurious life in the palace of his father, Suddhodana. These numbers over here are ages, things we know about what happened at different stages in his life. At age 16, he is said to have married his wife, Yashodhara. Around age 28, 29, they had a son, Rahula, and this is also the time when he leaves home. He had gone through the famous four chariot rides, and he decided that this life he had been living been with his father and his mother and his wife and a harem of women to keep him happy. He actually had three palaces to live in for each season, and was not enough. And so he leaves home, and it's a very poignant sort of moment in his life, this turning point. He leaves and he wanders. He goes out and becomes an ascetic, an itinerant ascetic for 6 years. And at age 35, he's said to have attained his awakening. And this happened in Bodh Gaya, which is in North India, sitting underneath a tree, meditating all night long. Perhaps have heard of that story too. I'm going to keep moving on because we're getting into, there's a lot more information still to come. After the awakening, from ages 35 to 80 is when he taught. So he taught for 45 years. Really, after he achieved this heightened state of awareness, this important body of knowledge, he taught it for 45 years, and he died at age 80. So whether these dates are accurate or not, or he actually lived 100 years later, there's agreement that he lived 80 years and that he taught for 45 years. And so these sorts of things are what we know with some certainty. Now, why is it so hard to know these things? Well, clearly, we're talking in ancient history. He lived a long time ago. This is five centuries before even, say, Jesus Christ, if we go back to trying to understand another important historical religious figure. So, you know, it's tough to maintain that kind of information over such a long period of time. We do have some biographies of the Buddha. Generally, there are three that are looked to as the most authoritative. But if we look at them, one of them is called The Great Story, Mahavastu. It's from the 2nd to the 3rd century CE. It still is at least 7 centuries after his life. Another one, The Graceful Description, Lalita Vistara, 6 centuries probably after his life. And then the most famous of the biographies is The Acts of the Buddha, the Buddha Charita of Ashvaghosha. This is the most famous. You can find translations of these. You can find translations of these fairly easily. Again, coming quite later than his life. And so what you see in these stories, you see a lot of legends attached to the things that happened in his life, and sort of an alteration, maybe an enhancement, maybe hyperbole is added to some of the things in his life. Yeah.
So is this a characteristic of maybe when people started writing things down? Or was this all verbal transmission? These stories.
When we start seeing, well, the stories are certainly transmitted orally for a long time, and that's where you can start to see some variation. Certainly, that will come with oral transmission. Even though in South Asia there's a remarkable amount of rigidity and fixed transmission, even in the oral texts, but that will add to it. We have written texts before these, and so this is when we're looking at the written texts. And then, of course, they're transmitted by scribes, and scribes make errors or they add things, perhaps. And it depends on who commissions them to do it. They may want them to emphasize certain things or other things. And it could be a whole host of reasons, you know, why you find the variation. So, again, the biographies, there's reason to question the historical accuracy. Again, the question, you may ask the question, well, is that so important? You know, maybe it's the spirit rather than the letter, the kind of thing that's important. And for certain people, certain traditions, one will be more important, both will be important, neither may be important, maybe something else is important. It's good to have as much information, in my opinion, as you can get. The region, yes?
How do those three line up generally? How do they compare? We don't know anything about that. How those three histories compare with one another?
They're similar. This one tends to be the most, shall we say, comprehensive, exhaustive. This one tends to be more fanciful, maybe you say, where you get more of a kind of legendary kind of figure. And this one tends to be the more nuts and bolts, skeletal, I guess you might say, sort of depiction. If we have to do it in a real rough and ready kind of explanation. They're all rather large. They're not just, you know, short little pamphlets or something. So they're all quite large. And they all tend to work off these sorts of basic childhood and family narrative that we get over here. But really, people dedicate their entire careers sometimes on just one of these texts. They're that big and that dense. And
Did the later authors, were they aware of the earlier ones?
There is evidence of conversation or awareness going back and forth, and people have, lots of different studies have suggested that, for example, that the acts of the Buddha may in fact be, you know, the basis for the Lalita Vistara, and that's why these dates are not, there's nothing specific here. And you'd probably be unwise to try and get too specific with a date for some of these texts, unless you're, a great deal of certainty. And the basis for that is looking at line by line of the text, looking at the stories that you find in them, and then there are arguments whether if you have a shorter story about the Buddha's life, for example, and it's elaborated upon later, that perhaps the shorter one came first. And the elaboration came later by different authors or somebody or different traditions. So, yeah, there's likely that there's awareness of the different stories that have been circulating from the different authors. It's a good question. Yeah.
I think that this might actually be what Brian was asking about, but what's the speculation about why it took so long for any of these biographies to be written after the life of the Buddha?
Well, there are others. These are the only ones we have today. These refer to other biographies as well, which would speak to your question as well. They just didn't survive. We don't have them. And so this happens in a lot of textual studies in this region and in every region, I would suspect. You find references to other books. So-and-so said this in this text, and we just don't know that text. It's never appeared. Maybe uncovered at some point, but generally we just say that this has been lost. So stories had been composed orally and in written form prior to these. But these are the ones we have, and these tend to, we have fragments also in the Nikayas and the Agamas, these other bodies of text that aren't full biographies. And some of those have survived, but they're fragments, you know, fragmentary stories. And others just, you know, we don't have. Yeah, so they have been told, certainly the Sangha at this point is big. And, you know, people had been trying, they've been wrestling for centuries at this point about trying to bring everything together that they could about the Buddha's life. But just for whatever sorts of reasons, due to climate, due to warfare, due to you name it, things didn't make it to us today.
What is the physical book? I mean, are they this thick? Are they papyrus?
They look like
or what? Yeah.
In South Asia, this is a good question. I wasn't going to show this till the end, but in South Asia, books or manuscripts, really what we refer to, were generally written on things like this. This is a manuscript from Sri Lanka, and what's in here are palm leaves, dried palm leaves, and bookending it are pieces of wood. This one's been nicely painted. They're not always so nice, but it would have looked something like this. And it could be smaller, it could be like that big. I've seen them even that big, and I've seen them much bigger or fatter even. But generally, this is what it would have looked like. You're all welcome to look at this. I was thinking that I was going to talk about this at the very end, and then you could, if you had wanted to, you could come up and piece through it, and so you're welcome to do that. You're welcome to look at it now, too. Okay. Great question. So the region, South Asia, I've been saying South Asia now a number of times. Of course, here's China, or excuse me, Asia over here. And the region, South Asia, is this smaller map over here. India being the biggest country in South Asia. Usually the countries that we put in South Asia are India, Bangladesh, Sri Lanka, Nepal, Bhutan, Pakistan. Afghanistan has a lot of shared history with South Asia as well, so we could possibly include it in there too. And then we go a little bit smaller here again. We're talking about the life of, when we talk about the life of the Buddha, we're talking about a very small region. 80 years is a good life. But it's happened in a very small area covering the southern border of Nepal, this state right here, which in contemporary India is called Bihar, and this one over here is Uttar Pradesh. And then if you blow that up, these are where some of the events in his life happened in a very small sort of area. Is there a red pointer on this thing?
I think so. I never use that, but yes.
So here's where he was born, for example, right here, and here's where he died, not too far. His first speech, his first talk, which will be part of the talk I'll give in March, the content of that talk, happened over here, right outside of the town of Varanasi, or also known as Benares, maybe you've heard of that town, right on the Ganges River, a very important city in India, a holy city for Hinduism and Buddhism. Then, really, most of the things that happened in his life happened in this small little area right here, South Asia. So what was it like before the Buddha came around? What was the prevailing sort of culture? Really, across that region, I'll go back again, across this region, my finger, from Pakistan up here down almost into what we say contemporary Bangladesh, northern India, including northern South Asia, prior to the Buddha, from roughly the 1300 to 600 BCE, we refer to it as the Vedic era. Yeah. And it's called the Vedic era primarily because of the texts that we have from that era. Right? There are four texts. They're called the four Vedas, and that's where we get the name. And we learn about the religion. We learn a little bit about the socioeconomics of that time, but mostly about the religion and a little bit about the philosophy. And these four texts are called the Rig Veda, the Sama Veda, the Yajur Veda, and the Atharva Veda. But the one that's really the most important is the Rig Veda. This is where we get a lot of our information about the religious climate of this period. And it's the one that most people know. If you've heard of the Vedas, if you've heard of the four, you've probably heard of the Rig Veda before the other three. And what we learn in the Rig Veda, one more thing. What we learn in the Rig Veda really becomes a precursor or a forerunner for classical and modern Hinduism. It's looked at as the sort of foundation scripture for Hinduism. And in a lot of ways, it may just be sort of a titular foundation stone, given lip service to. The Vedas are this, we recognize them, and then we move on, and really this is what we're talking about. You get a lot of that, but there's also recognition that the Vedas are pure revelation. Right? These were not created by human beings. They came from some source outside of this human world, of the earth. They were revealed to people, and therefore they're perfect. They're infallible. They're beyond human logic. Or we can understand them, but we can't argue with them or refute them. That's the important point. What's contained in there needs to be recognized as perfect. We learn about the religion, it's highly ritualistic. It's all about performing sacrifices, performing rituals. Some of them are day-to-day, three times a day. Some of them are weekly, bi-weekly. Some are bigger, where you go outside of your house and you perform with the people in your neighborhood or in your community. Some are larger, where you actually have to travel and do a pilgrimage and perform a big ritual. And usually what you're doing is you're sacrificing something, maybe food, often animals, small ones like goats, sheep, as big as horses. There's a famous horse sacrifice we learn about in the Rig Veda. And the reason for doing this is that you sacrifice, and that sacrifice goes up. After different recitations you find in the Rig Veda, goes up as an offering to the gods. And you hope that by appeasing the gods with these sacrifices, they'll give you something that you desire, something that you want. And what you want in what's your horseback? Curiously enough, that may actually work. You give up one to get many back. Yeah, could be. Maybe not the same one.
Do people, right?
Well, there's been speculation that there's actually human sacrifice in there, and the next slide will give you will suggest possibly as to why people have thought that. But in my estimation, there's no evidence of a real human sacrifice in there in these texts. The the idea here, we get notions of karma and rebirth already in the Rig Veda. So going back to 1300, 1200 BCE, it's quite old, these concepts. But karma at this point simply means the ritual performance. How are you doing when you're actually pouring things into the fire? How are you doing when you're reciting the hymns of the Rig Veda? You know, is it done properly? Are you doing these things in such a way that the gods are going to be happy with you and that they'll therefore give you what it is that you're looking for? What is it that you're usually looking for, at least we read in these texts, is that you're looking for some sort of comfort and security, prosperity, maybe a good harvest, maybe that you'll have more livestock in the next season. Livestock was a very important form of currency and wealth at this point in time and in this part of the world. It was really about material sorts of things. But there is also a sense of rebirth here in this text, and it's usually in the form of trying to come back again as a human in particular, preferably in a more comfortable position than you are now. And preferably in a place of more authority or power. If you're a woman at this time, to come back as a man, to place yourself in a position where you have more power, more authority. Really, that's what it's about, and more security in a lot of ways. Now, one thing we learn about in the Rig Veda, and again, these things are important here, especially this point here about this being a text of revelation. And yes.
So the concept of karma and rebirth at that time, was there any idea about coming back as spiritually enhanced or a better person, or was it all material power?
Well, there's more emphasis on material gain in this, I would say. When you start finding the spiritual or the moral emphasis on karma, it comes next. It comes in right almost when the Buddha is about to enter the world, and that's where he imbibed or is sort of his ideas become colored by the next stage after this. So that's a good question. There's lots of changes in the notions of karma over time. Within this part of the world. And then the Buddha and the various other figures that I'll mention today also do their own things with them. Yeah, so that's coming. So we get in a very important point about social hierarchy in the Rig Veda here that it's pretty astonishing if you think about it. Going back to about 1300, 1200 BCE, it still holds sway. It's still important in South Asia, especially India, today. And the story, it's a hymn. It's called the Hymn of the Cosmic Person. And this is where your question about if there's human sacrifice, people have wondered. It's a story where the gods are said to have this cosmic person, and he's supposed to extend beyond your imagination, you know, enormous, huge, so clearly not a human person. But the word they use is Purusha, which just means man. and that's perhaps where people have misinterpreted it. And they take this cosmic person and they sacrifice him essentially to themselves, right? To sacrifice to themselves. And what they do is they quarter him. And the four pieces of this cosmic person, as they fall out into the sacrificial fire, are where the social classes come from. People are born into these various pieces of the cosmic person, essentially. And so here's my very crude rendering of the appreciate your
from XKCD.
From where?
XKCD.
I don't know what that is. much more interesting in the Sanskrit text than the stick figure here. But what comes from the quarters, first we get from the mouth, this is what they specify, but you can also think of the head. And the connection there is that the place where you think and where that thinking comes out is where the uppermost class, the priestly class, the Brahmins, right? And these are names, maybe if you're familiar with Indian society, you've heard some of these names before. They're still around today. Came from there. From the arms comes the warrior class called the Kshatriyas. They're also the kings and the princes. So this is the class into which the Buddha was born. His father and mother were members of this class. Next, the biggest class of society in this part of the world, where most people belonged, the middle class, I guess you could call it, the merchant class, come from the thighs. So all the heavy lifting in society is done, essentially, right? The strong part. These are the people who, they're the agriculturalists. They're the ones who own and at least maintain the livestock. They may not own them, but they keep things coming and going to the market, growing the food, really the generators of the economy, essentially. And then down here, this is pointing to the feet. If you think of the person, the human person, right? We start up here with where the ideas are coming from. There's privilege given to that. The feet are the dirtiest part of the body. We get what's called a servant class, the Shudra class. So these are Vaishyas and these are Shudras. And in the text itself, this is the sacrifice. It falls out like this, and then it says people are born into these different classes according to your family, according to your, you know, your parents and their parents and so on and so forth. And this is, by the way, this is different than the caste system, right? There are two different terms, right? One, Varna, these are Varna and caste. You often hear that mistakenly used in reference to India. People say the caste system, and they're actually thinking of the class system, these four. The caste system is far more complicated. It comes in much later into Indian society. But within each class, there are castes, further divisions, subdivisions, and it changes from location to location in India. There are castes in Orissa, for example, you won't find in Kerala in the far south. And it's very complicated. It's extraordinarily complicated. But the Rig Veda says that of these four classes, there's a marked difference between these three and this class here. These three are what are referred to as a kind of noble class. They have the capacity to have access to the religious ritual, and hear the Sanskrit that's being recited for the ritual, in part because the jobs that are associated with these classes allow them to maintain the necessary levels of ritual purity. There are great laws of ritual purity and impurity in India at this time, and they get developed over time too. Whereas the servant class down here really exists so that these three classes don't have to engage in those sorts of things in society that keep you ritually impure. And so there's a sort of, you can see, it's a hierarchy. I don't think I need to spell it out too much more, but there's clear disenfranchisement sort of built into it. Now, the people who control the knowledge of this text, all four Vedas, who share that knowledge and what's contained in it, also happen to be this class here. And they're also the ones who perform the rituals on behalf of these others who have to hire them and so on, to keep things going. And of course, you need to do these rituals to ensure that you have success and you have comfort and so on and so forth. So this prevailed for a long time. And to an extent, this institution, social institution, is still present. Changes start happening in society across this part of what's now northern India around the 6th, 5th centuries BCE. So one of the big changes is that cosmopolitan centers start replacing tribal societies. You start seeing people moving together from places where they hadn't, you know, been sharing space before. And this, of course, opens up ideas to people. They start learning things they hadn't learned about before. You start talking to people that in ways you hadn't before. People start coming into northern India from outside of even South Asia around this time. And, of course, new ideas start coming up as a result of that too. Cosmopolitanism is a huge, huge, huge aspect of the changes that happen here. Trade really takes off too at this point. And it generated a new, richer money-based economy, you know, changing from barter-based economy into money. People are gaining things as a result of the things that they can sell. So you can imagine now who's going to be affected, who's going to start to gain more social capital in addition to economic capital as a result of that. The merchant class, yeah. So now they're a newly well-to-do merchant class in a way that they hadn't been before. They're still doing the same jobs that they had, but they're actually experiencing a sort of, you know, rise in their importance, their self-importance, so the way they're viewing themselves. And that's what the social capital is supposed to refer to here, is that they're actually starting to do things together, right? You know. Certainly saying unionizing is anachronistic in this case, but in a sense, they're, you know, start binding together, and they start asking for things, questioning things, more importantly, and that's what this last point is that they start questioning some of the seats of authority, right, that have been prevailing. And that seat of authority, you know, if we're just going to do this, you know, in a short lecture like today, it go back to that picture of the hierarchy is the top class, the priestly class. They're the ones, right, who have been the prominent authority figures in society at this time. And so that their institution, their place starts to become in question. With these changes then, especially with this point here, those people in the places of authority have to respond. How do they respond? Well, this causes a lot of the people in that class to rethink the nature of Vedic religion at that time. What's it all about, right? How can we maintain our position of importance in society, possibly our position of power and authority, and still be relevant in society? Or, you know, maybe what's been going on needs to be rethought and changed. And what we see come out of it, interestingly, is a revision, a reinterpretation of Vedic ritual along a very philosophical strain. It takes a very philosophical turn, and it comes out in a body of texts that are called the Upanishads. And these texts are somewhat well known in terms of Indian literature. There are 13 principal Upanishads, and there are some smaller ones too. But 13 principal ones, you can find translations of this fairly easily too if you're ever interested. And it ends up, we don't really have Hinduism yet. Hinduism hasn't come around as a tradition as we know it today. And the word Hinduism, by the way, is really modern. It's the 19th century sort of construction, but that's another lecture. The Upanishads serve as the philosophical tradition for what we call Hinduism today. And the things, I want to highlight four things that the Upanishads do, because this is where, from what you know about the Buddha's teachings now, you'll start to see where he starts to imbibe some things from South Asia context at this time. First, they develop this notion of samsara. Right? We had a very rudimentary notion of rebirth in the Vedic period, and we said, as I mentioned, that people wanted to come back and make sure they had comfort and some security and maybe a big family with lots of sons and lots of cattle or something. It was about that sort of thing. Kind of, you know, it's like the American dream, right? it sounds like it. I never thought of that before. That term, that passage from one life to the next is called samsara. It's a Sanskrit word that literally means going round. Going round, just around and around and around. You go for, and it's usually translated in popular literature as reincarnation. Right, that's the way you could think of it. But, or rebirth is also often called. What they do in the Upanishads, these philosophers, is they focus not on rebirth, about what to look forward into your next birth, but they say, hey, you know, with every rebirth, you actually get a redeath. Right? It's all about redeath. And what is redeath? It's painful. It's about suffering. Right? Every life is a suffering. It ends with suffering. You know, you may be happy for a while, you know, maybe a long while, and have great pleasure and so on, but at the end of the day, you die, and then you're born again. And by the way, birth hurts too, right? It's physically painful. You're right. It's physically painful for everyone involved, and happy too. But death, you're very lucky if it's not painful, you know, for you. Physically, it's often painful. Emotionally, it's often painful. And if it's not for you, it is probably for somebody else or many others. And they focus on that right there. And so to try and understand better the nature of samsara, they say, well, what is it that moves? Right? Because if we're talking about what we have now is somehow you know, playing out in another lifetime, there must be something that's part of me that goes into that next lifetime. Right? Or none of this would make sense. And they work on this right here, this term, Atman. And it's best translated as self. For a long time, when Christian missionaries were going over to India and translating the text, they called this the soul. Too much Christian baggage on that term right there. It doesn't really apply if we get into the nuts and bolts of what the Atman is. And so self is better. In fact, it's in the Sanskrit, it's a term that's self, it's a reflexive term, right? It means yourself. It really, really does. But it also has a philosophical connotation of this immaterial thing that is not subjected to the decay of the body and the various things that we experience in the world, like the physical stuff is. And then after you die, the body goes back to all the different sources that it came from, the earth. And the self goes on a journey. It goes on this reincarnation or this rebirth, redeath, samsaric journey, and it finds a new body. Well, how does it do that? It's very, people have interpreted, schools have come up with really complicated and elaborate systems for what happens on that actual journey, how long it takes. Some say it happens immediately. Some say it takes a really long time. You actually have to go through various levels of heavens and levels of hells and go through different trials and, you know, it, really interesting stuff. But at the end of the day, what determines where you end up is your karma. And here, karma takes on more morality, which I think, Kathy, you were starting to ask, you asked about in the Vedic era. Again, karma here is simply just means action. It's all it means, really. It doesn't have to have, and it's often used in Sanskrit literature just as the word for action or an act. No value added to it. Here it starts to take on a little bit more value, though. And there's a notion that there are some karmas that are good and there are some that are bad, in the sense that they have a consequence. Every act that you have has a consequence, and that consequence has to somehow come back to you. If you think of, I think it's Newton's third law of reciprocal action, or third law of motion, is for every action there's an equal and opposite reaction. That's it right here, you know, in a sense. Everything that you do, everything, every act, right? And this also often applies to your thoughts and your words, right? These also have karmic effects. Has to be played out some point, right? So everything I'm telling you today, I'm going to have to, it goes in my karmic debit account, and it's got to be worn down at some point. And it may happen in the next hour as I drive home. It may happen next week. It may happen next year. It may not happen until my next lifetime or three lifetimes from now. You don't really know that. That's a troubling sort of aspect of karma. You don't always know that. And it can be used as an explanation for things without really any evidence. Well, that happened because of something you did three lifetimes ago. So it's a confusing and sometimes troubling explanation. But that's what starts to happen here, to explain why you come back as a Brahmin as opposed to a Shudra, or excuse me, a priest as opposed to a servant, or a servant as opposed to a priest, or a goat as opposed to a merchant, or a blade of grass as opposed to a dog. And as I said, you can find really interesting sorts of explanations for if you do this, you'll come back as this. If you do this, you'll come back as this, and so on and so forth. At the end of the day, the goal for these people is release. Right? The goal is you want to get out of the suffering. Right? And this, I hope, is starting to sound Buddhist in some sense. You've heard this before. The sages of the Upanishads called it moksha. Literally, the word means release. And it's release from that, this thing right here. That's what they're after. And of course, the Buddhist term is nirvana, blowing out the translation in the Sanskrit of the word nirvana. And it's not the same thing, but very similar. And how do you do that, really? This is the complicated part, and why the path that the Upanishads laid out was never real popular. Because
you're preaching to the choir on that one.
Well, you know, if you find this to be similar to what you know about the Buddhist path, you know, you probably have a good take on this, right? The idea here is that if you have everything you do, every step you take, every act that you do has to somehow come back to you and be played out, the only way to get out of this is to eliminate your actions. That's really hard to do. And then, so one of the critiques that these sages had of the Vedic religion was that it's all about ritual. It's all about performance. All you're doing is acting, and it always has to have something come back to you. So you need to withdraw from society, really, is what they started teaching. And you need to really minimize your actions. You need to deny your body of things that we generally think it ought to have, like food and water, to the most minimal state. And you need to practice things like the development of knowledge through meditation, through yoga, things that really, you slow down, right? And minimize the accumulation of karma in your debit account, right? In your debit, karmic debit account. Can't do this, you know? And often what happens, or many people can't do it, is that you suffer. And the Buddha experienced this. He tried some of this during those 6 years after he left home, and he almost died. You've probably heard the story of when he lived off of one grain of water and one drop of water and one grain of rice a day, and he almost died. And he realized after he was almost dead that this is not the right way to attain release or nirvana from the suffering of the world. Yes.
I was just wondering if the Upanishads as texts also claim divine authority, like the Vedas, or not?
Yep, they do, in fact. And this is the last stage of the Vedic literature, the revelation that is... and so in Hinduism, you look at these texts, you go from the four Vedas, and then there's a bunch of things in between those four text categories, and then the Upanishads comes at the very end. Yes?
Maybe this is jumping the gun, but I think in Zen we would make a distinction between action that's done no-mindedly and action that's done full of thoughts.
Mm.
Intentionally.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, and this is something that the Buddha certainly talks about at length in terms of mindfulness, right? And good intention as opposed to or just intention at all, right? That here it's we can look at it in a more, I think, crass sort of way. It's about acts that you're doing, and they need to be minimized. Just acts, period. Yeah, it's an important point. And this is something that the Buddha adds to the conversations in South Asia, for sure, that's distinctive. Yes?
Just curious, when you speak of these things as being divinely revealed, where did they believe that they come from?
Yeah, this is somewhat challenging thing to answer, because as a scholar, as a historian, I've ascribed dates to these already for you, right? As though they've, and I'm talking about people who are distributing this knowledge, and people who belong to the tradition would say that, you know, these things just show, they just appeared, they're heard. The term is shruti, which it means that which was heard. And so these sages from the Vedic era, at the end of the Vedic era, who were giving out this information orally, this is all oral at this time, heard it. It's oral. And it didn't come from somebody's voice, or even from gods, because gods, the Vedic gods, and even in the Hindu gods, they have their own foibles. They're not perfect. They have, you know, problems, you know, at certain times. And so we don't know. It's an uncreated, non-human source. Yeah. It's a good question. It's a very troubling question to try to answer. Just it's this, that which was heard by these sages.
Wow.
So the sages of the Upanishads, I hope I'm okay. I'll try. The sages of the Upanishads belong to a kind of group that we would call as strivers, right? And the Sanskrit word is shramanas. And these strivers, they're striving for something. The Buddha, when he left home, after he saw those went on those four chariot rides, the fourth chariot ride, he saw one of these people, not necessarily somebody who followed the Upanishads, but somebody who was meditating. It was clearly after something intellectual and spiritual, and we would classify him as a shramana, as a striver. He went out for 6 years, and he caught up with different cohorts of people doing these sorts of things and practicing various things like meditation for the development of knowledge and wisdom and so on, and yoga, and you know all sorts of different things that are really outside of society. They happen, you know, in the hills, in the forest, they often refer to those places as. But the Upanishadic path is not the only one by any means that was active at the time of the Buddha. One thing that they almost all held in common, and that's what this little list over here is that they were anti-class and anti-social hierarchy. They were all opposed to what that cosmic person little picture I showed you earlier, a few slides earlier. They're all non-theistic. It wasn't about looking to a god or a goddess, especially giving a ritual to them, a sacrifice to one of them, as a means to try and help yourself, to try and get yourself some contentment and possibly something better, a release from suffering. It wasn't about that. It was about individual merit, you know, working yourself. Possibly with other people, you know, in tandem with other people, but at the end of the day, the other people can't do it for you. It's really something you need to try and cultivate, you know, on your own, whatever it is that you're after. Karma's still there, and a notion of rebirth is still there. And the reason there is an asterisk by each one of these terms is that these three things, these schools, these shramana schools, shared more or less, right? They didn't all have them. Most of them had these two. Some of them had at least one or all of those three down there. The first group I'll just mention is the Jains. The Jainism is the way you would refer to the religion today. It's still a religion today, very old. Its founder, Mahavira, right here, was a contemporary of the Buddha, from all that we know. And like Buddhism, there are many what they call Tirthankas, path makers, in Jainism. And Mahavira is the current one, the current path maker. He's the 24th one in Jainism. And he taught, and his followers now believe, that there's a life principle. What we call the self in the Upanishads, they called the life principle, or jiva, that's bound in samsara, bound in rebirth and redeath, by the laws of karma. Pretty similar to what we saw in the Upanishads, in fact. And they believe that you could actually burn away that karmic debit account I was talking about. You could actually like just burn it away, really. I mean that in a way because they practice the most extreme form of asceticism that you really can imagine. And more ascetic, more extreme, austere than most traditions in Asia that you find, where people are fasting to death. And that's often seen, venerated as a positive thing in some of the hagiographical literature of the saints of Jainism and so on. And they're also remembered and recognized for their commitment to ahimsa. Anybody know what ahimsa is?
Non-harm,
right. Yeah, non-injury. They're one of the most... lots of Asian traditions practice ahimsa, or non-harm, non-injury. But they're pretty radical in it. And in fact, you'll see people in India today, in some of their two primary Jain sects, who will wear a mask over their face so as not to inhale any life forms that are in the air, insects and so on, and sweep gently with a broom before every step that they take so as not to do any harm to anything that might be living on the ground. And it's a small religion in India today. It's from India, small religion, but it's still there. And very prominent and active in India. But they're also in North America. You'll see some Jains in Canada, in America. And the ones that you would see over here would be members of the Shvetambara sect, the white-clad Jains. So they possibly be all dressed in white. In India, there's two sects. There's the white-clad and there's the Digambaras, who are sky-clad. They're dressed in the sky, so they're naked. And they're very easily noticeable.
We visited one of the holy places of there, and before we went there, we had to take all leather off of our body.
Oh yeah.
You weren't allowed to wear anything made of any animal product on your body.
Yeah, I've heard that. I haven't had to do that. I've been to some Jain temples, but they tended to be more in more popular touristy areas, and so I suppose they've maybe got a little bit more lax in that. But that makes sense with the extreme level of ahimsa that they follow. And the Jains have some of the biggest and the most well-known animal hospitals, for example, in major cities in India that you'll find. So that's one of these Shramana groups. Another one, no longer around, it's called the Ajivikas, founded by somebody named Makali Gosala. These folks believe in destiny, fate, and they believe that in rebirth, but it's not about what you do now and the consequences of what you do now, but it's all written in stone already, right? So you're going to be reborn, and you may be reborn as something you're happy, you will be good or bad. Don't fret about it right now, you know, and you may not like the position you're in right now. You may like the position you're in right now. There's very little you can do about it, they said. And for them, contentment was really just an acceptance, accepting what you have. Right? This was the philosophy that they promoted. They're no longer around. Another group that's no longer around, called the Charvakas, or the Lokayatas, they're the materialists, right, of ancient India, and the logicians, right? Kind of a comparison to the sophists of ancient Greece, you might say. For them, at death, it's the end, right? It's all about matter. It's all about here and now, the things that you have. You could think that a group like this might tend towards a sort of hedonistic sort of philosophy, you know, trying great pleasure, having fun now because it's all over, you know, when it's all over. But that's not really what they were about. Rather, for them, pleasure or contentment came from what they called a balanced life. And hopefully that rings some Buddhist themes in your head too, the middle sort of way, a balanced life between work and play, between, you know, whatever it is that you can imagine a balance being struck, and meaningful relationships, compassionate recognition of other people. This was important to this group as well. And then there were whole groups of skeptics, different groups of skeptics around who just denied everything, right? No position. And the Buddha had plenty to say about them too. And we know about these things because in a lot of the literature there's actual conversations. We see these debates. South Asia is a historically a very textual society, and it's also a very argumentative, not in an angry sort of way, but in an intellectual sort of way. You see debates between different traditions all the time, and you win followers. You know, the Charvakas would win their followers by defeating the Ajivikas in debates. And same with the Buddhists and the Hindus and so on. This is how you amass the Sangha, essentially. This last slide, I apologize for the amount of text here, but I think it's important to bring us into what will be the next talk, which is really the doctrine in Buddhism. Gives us just some quick things that the Buddha said about these different groups that I've just been talking about. First, he questioned the integrity of revelation. Right, people have been asking good questions about revelation already. He questioned it too. Where did it come from? What are you talking about? You know, how can it be perfect? And in particular, he was against the social stratification. He also refuted, and this is a big one, right? The notion of the self in the Upanishads. What happens in this rebirth and redeath process, or you know, what the Jains call the jiva? He said that no, there's no self. And again, this will be in the next talk. We'll get to that. In part because when you're too attached to this notion of the self, if that's really all you're worried about, you can't be open to other people, right? You can't be selfless. That's really what you need to have in order to be compassionate, which is a hallmark, a very important aspect of his ideas and teachings. He disagreed with the Jains' notion that karma could simply just be cleansed through severe asceticism. And he disagreed with that on the basis of his own experience, right? He almost died, and he realized that you can't find contentment if you're dead. And, you know, and if you just do that, it's not going to happen. He said that the Ajivika's fatalism, their belief in destiny, simply just discouraged any effort whatsoever. Right? If you just say, well, all right, that's that, you know, then it just gave up, you know, you're giving up your commitment, right, which is a very important part of the Eightfold Path, your commitment, your effort towards gaining insight, wisdom, and knowledge. With the materialists, he just thought that it was, you know, they were deluded in thinking that anything you are attached to here on this earth, right, which is impermanent, can give you any sort of lasting happiness or enjoyment. And then to these groups of skeptics I alluded to, which ancient India had, he simply suggested that they avoided taking any position at all, right, just by denying everything. And that itself was not a good thing because it prevented you from arriving at any real truth, right? And that's what the Buddha was after. That's what all the Shramanas really were after, is trying to arrive at some sort of truth. How are y'all doing? You all right? Because that's the end of the talk, and then there were I was going to say a couple words about the traditions that came after. Shall I continue?
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
I have a question.
Yes. Yep.
I'm curious about the impact of the primary agricultural society that then became more materialistic, merchant, the rise of the merchant class and whatever, and the impact of that as you went from the collective doing rituals to the more individual asceticism, because it sounds like the Buddhist contribution is taking it back more toward the experience of the divine as more of a collective.
It's more of a
A collective experience as you're losing the self in the service of others or in the service of life.
So the cosmopolitan development and this new wealth of the middle class certainly had an effect on changing the way in which the ritualism of the Vedic era was happening. I don't want to give the impression that the Upanishads, those real highly ascetic traditions, were the prevalent practice across that region. It was a very hard thing to do, and a lot of people couldn't necessarily do it. It's a very philosophical sort of position. And so you still find a lot of people who are practicing in a ritual sort of way. But there's an overt and noticeable critique of what had been happening before, which opens up room for these various groups of strivers. And I think, if I'm answering your question correctly, what the Buddha adds to that is he adds, yes, there are ways to go about attaining things that we're after, release from suffering in particular, on a path that is hard, right? It requires, you know, some serious meditation in order to attain insight and a serious commitment, and it can take the form of a kind of ascetic path, but there's also a lay path too, right? You know, it can be done in a variety of different ways, and part of, I think, the appeal of somebody like the Buddha, and the Jains had a little bit of both sides too, even though they were very ascetic, is that they were looking for, the Buddha in particular, was looking for a practical way to help men and women achieve these things. And if it had to be done in a community, it could be done in a community. It might not happen as quickly as you want it to happen in certain settings, but he's looking for a solution for people, you know, that, you know, that they could find amenable to their lifestyle. Did I address what you're asking?
Not all of it, but yeah. Well, I don't want to dwell on, but I was just impressed with how, you know, from the agricultural to the cosmopolitan, there was a shift in the way people understood their relation or their religious beliefs.
Yeah,
it was a distinct shift.
There's definitely a shift, and it caused the people at the top, I guess we'd say at the top, to rethink what it was that they were doing. But it still persisted, and that stratification's still there, even today. Not in the same way it was back then, and it depends on where you go in different parts of India, the degree that you'll still see it. And so it didn't just go away necessarily, but people started finding opportunities to question it and perhaps take a different path. And that's the kind of space or environment in which the Buddha entered, which is important because it gave him the opportunity to appeal, you know, for others to hear him, really, you know, and take notice, and possibly follow the things that he was teaching. Yeah. Okay. So after Gautama, Buddhism spreads enormously. These next few slides really are just general stuff. I'm just going to say, just because I just wanted to touch upon these things. So I'm going to mention three different traditions, we'll say. Theravada is the first one I'll say. It's generally translated as the way of the elders. And this map down here shows where today you'll see Theravada primarily, Theravada Buddhists primarily living and practicing in Asia, right? Of course, there are Theravada Buddhists here, you know, right out in Rochester too, but we're looking at Asia now. And that's one place really only still in South Asia, and that's Sri Lanka. And then you go into Southeast Asia is where you find mostly Theravada traditions. Now, Theravada is perhaps the oldest form of Buddhism still around today. It's one of the original, what we would call the, not the original, one of the earliest 18 schools of Buddhism that existed in South Asia. So after the Buddha dies, you find this in a lot of traditions that have one central sort of figure, is that after there's a sangha or a community that comes up around him, what do you do, you know, when the leader passes away? It's confusion. And, you know, how do you set up a sort of institution so that people can continue to learn the messages that he had been teaching and practice in the way that he suggested and so on? And you find a fragment, a bunch of different divisions. 18 schools is what we have in the literature referred to, 18 schools. Only one of them survives today, and that's Theravada. Theravada has what we call a Pali canon, a canon body of literature that is the foundational scripture for a tradition. It often refers to a religious body of literature, but you know, in universities you talk about the canon of English literature or something too. It's what you have to know if you're going to really become a student or an expert in some sort of area or a practitioner. And Pali is just the language in which it was written. This is a language very much like Sanskrit, but different, a little bit different. And so Theravada's Pali canon, all the 18 different schools had their own canons in Pali also. And what this tells you is that they all had a different sort of emphasis on what the Buddhist teachings and his sayings really were about and how you ought to organize them so that they can be preserved over time. But again, we only have the Theravada one, and it's referred to as the Tripitaka, which translates into the three baskets. So there are three bodies of literature that go into the Pali Canon. The first is called the Sutra Pitaka, and this is the discourses that the Buddha, that Gautama apparently said. So after he became enlightened, right, he went out, he actually sat underneath the tree for, in some of the stories, up to a week, just enjoying this new state he was in. And then he went out and he taught after some prodding, right? And in fact, the prodding that he had, and some stories say, is that it was a Hindu god that encouraged him to do it because the Hindu god wanted to know what the Buddha knew. There's a lot of this back and forth in the mythologies between Hinduism and Buddhism to try and show who, you know, one up one another. And in any case, he went out and he gave that first talk, the first turning of the wheel of Dharma, as it's referred to. And this is what's in the Sutra Pitaka, all the things in those 45 years that he said. And the Pali Canon, the Tripitaka, was developed over long time. It didn't just come about after he died. But there were a series of Buddhist councils where the Sangha would get together and the eldest monks, the ones who were recognized as, you know, perhaps the most authoritative, the ones who knew the Buddha the best, often ran these. And then later, over time, important political figures would call these councils together and they would essentially put all this together and try and agree upon something that they would pass on from time to time. The Sutra Pitaka is said to have been put together pretty quickly after he died in that first council, within the year of his death. And legend tells us that his closest disciple, Ananda, who's also his cousin, memorized everything that he ever said, every teaching that he ever said, and he's the one responsible for giving us what we have in the Sutra Pitaka. The next Pitaka, the next basket, is the Vinaya Pitaka. This is the rules of conduct for monks and nuns, what to do if you're going to be a Buddhist monk or nun. There are a couple different, two of the three, there's possibly a fourth Buddhist council, but two of the three Buddhist councils were really about this Pitaka right here. Because monks, were doing things that some other monks considered to be against the teachings of the Buddha. And so then they would have to call a council together of the elders and say, hey, listen, these monks over in this town, right, are actually aligning themselves with some of the politicians. They're becoming political in their practice. And is that right? Does that mesh or does that coincide with what we read in the Sutra Pitaka? And so they would have to sort these sorts of things out and they would ratify the Vinaya over time. And then the third one, the Abhidharma Pitaka, this is usually considered to have come last of the three baskets. This is the metaphysical basket. It's really just an analysis of this. Right? Because, you know, he gives a lecture on the Four Noble Truths at Deer Park after he's been awakened, and, there's that. There's the lecture. Well, you know, what does that mean? You know, it's not that simple. You need some sort of commentary, and this is really what this is about. And it's not just any commentary. It's a highly philosophical and psychological. Buddhism, lends itself well to psychological conversations and analysis, and that's what you find in here. And the legend of this is that he first shared the Abhidharma, and that's also a lot of legends say that week he was sitting under the Bodhi tree after he became enlightened, he was sitting there, glowing, and he was just contemplating this, right? The complexity of all of the things that he just really, that just came together that night. This, the enormity, the brilliance, pick your superlative. And it says that a lot of traditions will say that he shared this first with his mother, right, who is dead. He went to visit her in heaven, and he shared the Abhidharma with her, is one of the
Which mother?
Maya, yeah. The his mother.
His birth mother.
His birth mother, yeah. What's this say? Oh, the form we have it now, the Theravada Pali Canon, was officially put to writing in sometime in the first century of the Common Era. And then there are other canons that we should note too. This is not the only one. There's a Chinese Tripitaka, for example, And then in Tibet and also Mongolia, I didn't write that there, we have the Kangyur and the Tengyur. These are also kinds of canons for the traditions that developed there. This text here would be an example of how you would find the putting together the writing in the first century right here. Throughout South Asia, this is commonly how things would be put together into a book form, which you asked earlier. And in the middle here are dried palm leaves, and on top is, and on the bottom is wood, and there are holes drilled in between here, and that's the binding, put together with strings like this. And students would, or anyone, would sit down, put it in front of them, and you lift off the top like this, the string, and I'll invite you all to come look at this up here. It's easier if I keep it down here. I'm sorry if you can't see it. And then there's just stacks and stacks of these palm leaves, and you pick them up, and you read one side. Some of them are written on front and back, and you just flip them over like this.
Is it ink?
And it's not ink, actually. And you just go through. This one's on front and back. A stylus would gently carve into the palm leaf, which makes it even more incredible when you have it on both sides.
Oh, God.
And then a kind of graphite is smeared across the top.
How old is this?
This one's about 100 years old, and it's from Sri Lanka. So it's not that old, really. In the grand scheme of things. I think my first Sanskrit teacher brought a manuscript he had from Nepal to our class one day, and it was from the 12th century, so it was quite old. And a big difference there is that the climate in Nepal, especially in Tibet or some places up in the mountains, is certainly kinder to things like this, manuscripts like this, than tropical climate like Sri Lanka or places in South India.
Yes. So you said the only surviving canon is the Pali canon, but you study Sanskrit. So what's that written in?
This is not a Buddhist text.
Oh.
This is in Sinhalese. It's in the language of Sri Lanka. This is actually a Hindu text. But the tradition of writing and preserving texts would be the same.
Got it.
Buddhism really started to flourish in India because it had political patronage. This is really something that you find with most traditions historically, is that they start taking off when kings support them. And in the case of these early Buddhist schools in India, one of the greatest patrons was Ashoka, King Ashoka. He was the grandson of the Mauryan emperor named Chandragupta. And he, complicated life, had a conversion-type experience. He was a really bloodthirsty warrior king until he was in a battle one day and saw these, just the story goes that he saw, you know, just dead bodies everywhere, and just had a, you know, hate to cross traditions, but a road to Damascus kind of experience. But that's what he says. And he ends up supporting Buddhism, preserving a lot of information on what are called the Edicts of Ashoka about the life of the Buddha that we use to piece together some of the things that I've talked about today, which are carvings on these big stones, again from the same area in northern India. And he sent out missionaries, east and west, and north and south, to talk about Buddhism. And he really helped Buddhism get beyond the borders of what is India today. And it says that his son Mahinda here is the founder of the Sangha in Sri Lanka, a very important Theravada location. The paradigmatic figure, really, in Theravada is this idea of an arhat. Worthy one is really what it means. And it's somebody who's attained a state of awakening, essentially, and will pass on at the death of this body into parinirvana, will not come back into rebirth. Right? And the reason that I put this up here is because in the next tradition I'm going to mention, there's a differentiation between what the paradigmatic figure ought to be. For Theravadins, this is the one. This is the one. You become an arhat, you get to move on. You don't, you're out of the suffering. And it's a positive thing, and these people are really gifted and really have a lot of meditative insight. But when we get to the next tradition, Mahayana, there's a little bit of concern over that being the paradigmatic figure, what you ought to be striving to be. And so Mahayana, the great vehicle, just before the turn of the common era, and then several centuries after, there's a whole movement of literature, Buddhist literature. Now we're talking from 4 centuries after the death of the Buddha, where people start concentrating on this idea of the arhat. What does it mean to just become free from suffering? What if we could all become Buddhas instead? What if we all have the capacity? We all have this idea of what others have called Buddha nature, right? Maybe that's possible too. Maybe we ought to be striving for that instead of just some kind of a holy saint who passes on and doesn't come back, right? Which maybe doesn't have as much impact and influence, positive influence on the world and help for other people. And this body of literature develops into a whole movement, a sort of reform movement, which develops into Mahayana right here. And this last point down here is historically important. The Mahayana practitioners, they come up with a term for those 18 schools of Buddhism who are in South Asia to distinguish themselves against them. They refer to themselves as practitioners of Mahayana, of the great vehicle, or the great way, you could also translate it as. Those other ones who are striving to become arhats are practitioners of the Hinayana, which literally means the deficient vehicle, or often called the lesser vehicle. And so, it's a pejorative term. It's used as a way to distinguish themselves, but it's also meant to show that we're better than them. And so you see, even within, a religious tradition, there's lots of disagreement, argumentation. And funny enough, it's not funny, but the scholarship on Buddhism for a long time in the 18th, 19th century, when Westerners go over and they see Hinayana written all over the place, and they're studying with, looking at Mahayana traditions, they perpetuated this term as an actual term for these early Buddhist schools. It's the Hinayana. So lots of generations of scholars in the West grew up calling these traditions Hinayana, when in fact you would find no Theravada practitioner who would refer to him or herself as a Hinayana practitioner. So it's important to know these sorts of disputes, I think, historically, to understand where people are coming from. So instead of the arhat, what one ought to strive to become for Mahayana is this figure of an awakened being, a bodhisattva. And a bodhisattva is somebody who, like the arhat, has attained awakening, but decides not takes what they call a bodhisattva vow. I refuse to go into my parinirvana, the final blowing out, and I'll hang around in samsara in some form. And in different traditions, they have superhuman powers. They're often bodhisattvas are only superficially connected to the world. They have lots of really amazing, unhuman, abilities. But until everybody can attain enlightenment, and there are usually three ways in the literature that bodhisattvas are said to assist people on that journey. One is like a ferryman, meaning that you get them in the boat and you just go alongside with them from one shore to the other. Another is like a shepherd, where you're actually standing behind and sort of nudging people, where they need to go. And then the third is like a king, where you're out in front, and you say, just follow me, and this is how you get there. And you've perhaps read stories about different bodhisattvas, and you can see different examples of where these three maybe have played out. Vajrayana is the last thing I'm going to talk about. It's the thunderbolt vehicle is the literal translation, but you often see it called the diamond vehicle too. Vajraya is really a thunderbolt in Sanskrit, but diamond is also the way it's translated. This is tantric Buddhism in a lot of ways, and also called esoteric Buddhism. And by that, we mean that you need to be initiated into the path by somebody who's already gone through the practice. You can't just show up and start practicing it, in other words. It's something that you have to have access into by seasoned and experienced practitioners. It's the diamond or the thunderbolt here is meant to represent the imperishable nature of awakening, emptiness, compassion, and insight. These are things that will come up in the next talk. There are two takes on Vajrayana. If you read the old Indian Vajrayana literature, Mahayana literature, they say that Vajrayana is part of Mahayana. It falls under that umbrella of Mahayana Buddhism. If you read the Vajrayana literature in Tibet, for example, where most of the Buddhism you find in Tibet is Vajrayana, Vajrayana is a third path. It's a third way, a third vehicle, and it's its own thing. So there's disagreement about that. So here... I said that was the last slide. This is the last slide. These are the four schools of Vajrayana Buddhism that you find in Tibet. Nyingma, Kagyu, Sakya, Galug, and Galug is the one where the Dalai Lama belongs to. And so that perhaps you knew that. Sometimes when I teach Tibetan Buddhism to students, they didn't realize, they thought that the Dalai Lama was just the head of all Tibetan Buddhism, but just one of the four schools. And then, but you find Vajrayana elsewhere. It's not simply in Tibet, so that's the last thing I just want to say. And those are other places that you find it. So. With that, stop. Oh. Happy to any more questions you have. Yes?
I just had one question. She actually mentioned about the historical Buddha's life pretty much follows the traditional story. I can't remember where I had read this, but I once read this account that historically he was, like his father was probably did not rule the province or the area on his own. It was probably a part of an oligarchy. And ruled with many others, and that his father, while no doubt wealthy, wasn't anywhere near the opulence that the traditional story maintains, and that the Buddha, Gautama, would have attended council meetings with his father and so forth, and would have known about goings-on in the community, and he would have had plenty of exposure to aging and sickness and death, and that he was never, and he did not live this incredibly sheltered life. The way the traditional story maintains.
Yeah.
I'm just wondering if you wanted to comment on that. What do you think of that account?
Well, on the one hand, I say, well, yes, I agree with that. I think we should be careful not to mystify the life of the Buddha and to think that he had no idea what was going on. You know, some of the stories say that he went out in that first chariot ride, and when he sees an old person who has somehow escaped the cleansing that his father is supposed to have performed in Kapilavastu, where they lived, he had no idea what it was, and yet he lived on a property with hundreds of servants, and none of them were old. You know, you have to ask yourself, you wonder, and if he's being trained as a prince, like you said, you know, he's shadowing his father in many ways, and what happens? And at that time in northern South Asia, lots of warfare going on between territories and so on, and his father was in charge of great armies, or at least an army. And often in a consortium with other kings, as you say, in the region of Kosala. He was only the king of Kapilavastu, and Kosala is a bigger region, and there are other kings of other territories. So, yeah, I think there's a tendency to mystify some of these figures and add sort of a mythical or a legendary element to highlight the magnitude of the change in his life, maybe, perhaps. He was a brilliant. We also know that he was a brilliant student. If he was that brilliant at the arts, at literature, at mathematics, at astronomy, and sports, and all this, how could he have not have realized that people age the way that they do? You know, these are great questions to ask as a historical critic, right? You want to ask these things, and then you want to ask, why might they be sanitized, or why might they be downplayed in a tradition? And there are possible reasons for that. So I think. You know, there's a good reason to suggest that the stories, the biographies, where they give that kind of a clean picture, are probably not giving us the whole picture. Yeah, that's my take. Yeah.
Thank you so much.
Oh, yeah.
Back on March 11th, so stay tuned.
Yeah, if I may say that talk will be probably much more interactive, even though you guys all asked great questions today. More room for discussion, I think.